From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the comeback of the singer known as the Country Caruso. In the 60s, Johnny Bush had several country hits. He also played with Willie Nelson's band and wrote a song that Nelson has recorded many times, Whiskey River. But in 1972, Johnny Bush lost his voice due to a neurological disorder that affects the vocal cords. With the help of vocal coaching, he's able to sing and talk again, and he has a new CD. Also, rock critic Ed Ward profiles the career of blues singer and guitarist Lonnie Johnson, who made many recordings of his own, accompanied such jazz performers as Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, and influenced such performers as B.B. King and Elvis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea says tsunami victims are still trying to piece together what's left of many of their villages. A wall of water 23 feet high smashed into the northern coast of Papua New Guinea last Friday, washing whole villages into the ocean. Residents had no warning. Prime Minister Bill Skate says islanders need more medicine and money to help cope with the disaster. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott has concluded the first day of talks in New Delhi with India's leaders over nuclear testing and non-proliferation issues. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from New Delhi.
Both sides characterized today's meetings as constructive and agreed to meet again in Washington next month. Deputy Secretary of State Talbott said the talks were aimed at restoring U.S.-India relations to the level that both countries want and deserve. "We have established a very wide canvas on which we are seeking to paint," he said, "but we have a long way to go." Today's meeting was the third between Talbott and Indian Foreign Policy Advisor Jaswant Singh since India and neighboring Pakistan conducted their nuclear tests in May. The U.S. is trying to convince both countries to give up further testing and deployment of nuclear weapons and to sign the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. After more meetings with Indian officials tomorrow morning, Talbott travels to Islamabad for talks with Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, New Delhi.
President Clinton is visiting New Orleans, where he will address the American Federation of Teachers Convention. While there, he's promoting safety in schools. In a speech, he's expected to offer support for school uniforms and stronger curfews. He'll also speak of stricter discipline in schools following a spate of school shootings that has killed several students. The search for fugitive bombing suspect Eric Rudolph is taking its toll on agents who are conducting the manhunt for Rudolph in North Carolina. Scott Jagow of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte.
The heat, grueling terrain, and dangerous round-the-clock work is wearing down some of the more than 200 searchers looking for Rudolph in the rugged mountains of western North Carolina. Today, some of those searchers will be replaced with new people. But the FBI isn't saying whether it's any closer to capturing the 31-year-old who's wanted in connection with January's fatal abortion clinic bombing in Birmingham, Alabama. It's been more than a week and a half since Rudolph showed up at a food store owner's home, took 6 months' worth of provisions, and fled. The FBI is also in this for the long haul. Authorities say the round-the-clock manhunt will continue until Rudolph is captured. For NPR News, I'm Scott Jagow in Charlotte, North Carolina.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 4 points to 9,333. Trading is light on volume of 236 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index, however, is up nearly 13 points at 2021. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, there are plenty of quarterly earnings reports out today. Plus, there's news of a big bank merger to open Wall Street's week. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
SunStar Trust and Questar have become the latest banks to announce they plan to merge. Atlanta-based SunTrust said today it will pay $9.5 billion for Questar, based in Richmond. The combined bank will have over 1,000 branches in six states and the District of Columbia. Some big companies also unveiled quarterly earnings today. Financial services firm Travelers says its second quarter operating profits rose by 5% to just under $1 billion. Fast food giant McDonald's says its operating income rose to nearly $470 million. The biggest earnings report of the day, though, is not due out until after the close of business. That's when computer giant IBM will detail earnings. Most analysts expect only a slight rise from the same period last year, mostly due to ongoing weakness in Asia. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Environmental Protection Agency says it is standing by its ruling on secondhand smoke despite a federal judge's ruling over the weekend. The EPA issued a report in 1993 that said secondhand smoke causes cancer, but a judge ruled the report was flawed. The issue came up in a suit filed by the tobacco industry. The judge ruled the study findings were based on inadequate science and didn't prove its conclusion. Still, the study has been used to restrict smoking in public places. A new health care plan backed by the Clinton administration is upsetting privacy advocates. The plan, which Congress will start debating today, tracks the medical histories of individuals. The New York Times reports this will be done by computer database, and every American will receive a computer code. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Country singer Johnny Bush is making a comeback. His problem wasn't whiskey and drugs, which have been the downfall of many performers. It was a rare neurological disorder that interferes with the functioning of the vocal cords. When it struck in 1972, the singer, who was nicknamed the Country Caruso, had trouble singing and talking. It took 6 years for Bush to get an accurate diagnosis. Years of vocal coaching have enabled him to sing and speak in ways that get around the disorder. In the 60s and early 70s, Bush was best known for his soulful singing about cheating and heartache. He also played in Willie Nelson's band and wrote the song Whiskey River, which Nelson has recorded many times. Now Bush has a new CD on Watermelon Records called Talk to My Heart. Let's hear a track from it before we meet him. This is Any Fool Could See.
Any fool could see that she wasn't happy. It was plain as the paint on her face. Any fool could see that she was a lady who'd taken all that she could take. The way she was feeling was hard not to notice. She was wearing her heart on her sleeve. Any fool could see she was planning to leave. At least any fool but me.
Johnny Bush, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me today.
This recording is part of your continuing comeback. Could you describe for us what the voice problem is that you've had over the years?
Certainly. The voice problem that I have and will continue to have is called spasmodic dysphonia, which is a term that took 20 years for some of the doctors throughout the country to tell me what it was, because in my part of the Texas, when this happened to me, nobody seemed to know what it was. It's when the larynx just closes off. The larynx, the vocal cords, is controlled by a part of the brain called the basal ganglia. Between the basal ganglia and the vocal cord, there's a short circuit, which simply means when I try to speak, they slam shut. So with the proper breath control and relaxation and a lot of prayer and speech therapy, I've been able to control that to the point to where I can do interviews again, where a few years ago I could not.
So what exactly slam shut?
The larynx slams shut. Your larynx is like imagine two rubber bands that are triangular, and when you breathe, they open. When you go to speak, they come together and they vibrate. A little column of air comes through the closed larynx, which causes your phonation, your sound. So you can imagine if they just slapped like this, the way I used to have to talk would be like that.
Does it hurt your voice when you
No.
when you do that?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not pain related at all. Very frustrating.
You're right. Just describe what happened when you first started losing your voice. I think you were performing when it first started to go on you.
It happened April 17th, 1972, I was in the valley in South Texas when it just quit. So I immediately went to my ENT specialist, who checked my larynx periodically, because when you sing in the range that I do, you get a lot of singers get polyps, especially if you use your voice wrong. So you have to be very careful. So two or three times a year, I would have my larynx examined. So when this happened, I went back to him. He examined my larynx. There's nothing wrong, but I do see spasms. Said, possibly you're overworked, you're tired. I was working 30 days a month. I was going from Miami, Florida to San Francisco, you know, tours nonstop. So we thought it was stress-related, fatigue, allergies, anything they could think of, you know. So the first thing they done was put me on Valium to the point where I was hooked on Valium. And when that didn't work, I started going to speech therapy. So it's taken 20 years for me to get to the point now to where I can do an interview like this.
When you first started having this problem, did it happen to you on stage while you were singing?
That's exactly how it happened. I was at the Jungle Inn and close to Harlingen, Texas. I know exactly.
What happened?
Like it was yesterday. I just felt this tightness slam shut. I was trying to sing Danny Boy. I got so frustrated, I threw my guitar halfway across the dance floor. I went outside and just fell to my knees, you know, and I couldn't believe it. I breathed fine and felt fine. But something in my mind told me it was over. If the freedom of my voice was over. Something told me that.
What did you think it was? Did you think you were being
kind of
punished by God, or
yes,
that it was a psychological
yes
disorder?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I've done some pretty rotten things, and no more, no less than anybody else who has the hits the skyrocket overnight, and all the pretty girls, and you're married, and you get a divorce, and you fall in love, and you're in love with two or three different women, and you're doing things that you know that you weren't brought up to do. For many, many years, I felt like God was punishing me, and the best way to punish me was to take away the very thing that I wanted most to do, was to sing. And for many years, I believe I was being punished by the Lord. I sure did.
I think some of the doctors early on told you that it was probably some kind of psychological disorder that was behind it.
Psychosomatic, yes.
So that must have kind of driven you crazy when you were thinking, oh, it's something I'm doing or something I'm thinking that's responsible for this. So,
it's awful. It's terribly frustrating. And when a doctor can think of nothing else, now I'm not putting the medical profession down, because since all the studies have been done on spasmodic dysphonia, we have found out that only 1 in 35,000 people have this. We also know that it's not terminal. So in the medical colleges, if they hit on it at all, they usually give it to the speech therapist to deal with. The doctor doesn't deal with it at all. It'd be very simple if they could give you a pill or a shot, and it would go away. It's not the case. So the being misdiagnosed today, I can tell you horror stories to where they are actually clipping the nerve to one side of the vocal cord by paralyzing one side. The patient is able to speak very breathy, but he can speak.
One of the treatments that you got over the years was injections of something that's very much like botulism. It's a toxin that's similar to the botulism toxin.
It's not similar. That's exactly what it is. A teaspoonful of it in the water supply in Philadelphia would kill every human being in Philadelphia.
That's reassuring.
That's how strong it is.
So they inject some of that right into your vocal cords.
Right into the larynx.
And
but a very, very, very minute dosage.
Mm-hmm.
And in 90 days, it wears away. However, here's the danger. Nobody knows the residual effect yet. So if you go back every 90 days, say for 10 years getting these shots, who knows what the residual effect's going to be down the line.
Now, if I understand correctly, here's what happened with you. Before you got the injections, you were kind of able to sing, but you couldn't talk.
Exactly.
But after you got the injections, you were able to talk better, but you lost your singing voice.
I'll tell you how that happens. Your vocal cords open and close, like I explained a while ago. When you breathe normally, they open up. When you go to speak, they come together. A little column of air comes up through the cords to vibrate to where you can phonate. When you're singing, the cords also have to stretch, like, they stretch. After Botox, they don't stretch anymore. So instead of having, you got, that's the only way you could do that. So forget singing.
I'm thinking how horrible that must have been. You get this injection, you're able to talk,
then
but
I
now
was
you can't sing.
But I can't sing.
So you had to choose between what you wanted to do, medicine that could help you talk, which would leave you unable to sing,
right,
or not taking the medicine and not being able to talk but being able to sing. So how did you decide
what to
do?
I've never sold a record yet talking.
Yeah, but you can't get into a conversation just singing.
Exactly. I have, through breath control, have learned to control it to the point to where I'm, if anybody didn't know, probably wouldn't think that I have spasmodic dysphonia. They wouldn't know.
My guest is country singer Johnny Bush. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air.
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. All in that wonderful game that we know as love.
Back with country singer Johnny Bush. Since 1972, he's had a rare neurological disorder that affects the vocal cords. But with the help of vocal coaching, he's speaking and performing again. He has a new CD called Talk to My Heart. What are some of the vocal exercises you've been doing to strengthen your voice?
A young man I met here in Austin a few years ago, his name was Gary Catona. He's an Italian opera coach. He called me up. He asked me one question. He said, when you yawn, you know, like, oh, when you yawn like that, John, can you talk without any problems? And I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I can't. He said, I can help. So he had a series of exercises using the piano, different pitches of the scale, using the Italian vowels, E, I, O, U. You would sing these. He would place your cheekbone, your jawbone, and your head and your chin in a proper position with your back perfectly straight. And you would sing these vowels on his instruction, using the yawning sound of your voice. You remember Yogi Bear cartoons?
Right.
Well, as silly as this may sound, that the yawning effect is the way you start strengthening your voice. Do you remember Bert Lahr and the Cowardly Lion? If you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, The Wizard of Oz.
Bert Lahr played the Cowardly Lion. And he would talk like this. Put him up, put him up, put him up, put him up. He spoke with that natural yawn in his voice. Elvis Presley had that natural yawn. Don't ever, don't, you know, could you hear that in the voice?
Yeah.
It takes all the strain off the larynx. So we would, 3 times a week, Gary Catone and I go through a series of scales from the low to as high as I could sing using the Italian vowels, which it strengthened because I didn't, see, once you quit using something, you lose it. My voice was so weak, we had to build the muscles around the cord, had to strengthen them. So in essence, it was like taking a barbell or a dumbbell with your arms. It's the same effect. Also, it strengthens your diaphragm. It strengthens your breath. It's just strengthening those muscles that become weak because I wasn't using them.
So so do you find that you sing differently now that you know more about breathing and you know more about how your voice works and you have that yawning singing technique and all of the stuff that you learned about the Italian vowels? Do you sing different?
I still sing the same. It still sounds like me. The only difference is I don't sing as high. First of all, I'm 63 years old now, and I don't have the elasticity left in the chords anymore. I've lowered my keys because I was told that would help, which it has. I've lowered the keys. I would think, compared now to the peak of my career, I'm maybe 80% of what I was when I was at my peak. So I'll settle for that.
Well, I thought we could listen to a record from early in your career. And
sure.
This is from 1967. And I thought we'd play Lonely Street. I think this is just a terrific performance.
Thank you.
And I also think it shows your voice when it was in a higher range. And we can hear how you sounded.
And I was 30 years old, remember.
Right. Your voice would have been a higher range there no matter
right.
what.
Okay. Exactly.
Okay, this is Johnny Bush, recorded in 1967, Lonely Street.
I'm looking for that lonely street. I've got a sad, sad tale to tell. I need a place to go and weep. Where's this place called Lonely Street? A place where there's just loneliness, where dim lights bring forgetfulness, where broken dreams and memories meet. Where's this place called Lonely Street?
That's Johnny Bush, recorded in 1967. Well, I guess we can hear why you got the name The Country Caruso.
Thank you for that. There was a music critic in Houston by the name of Bob Claypool, who worked for the Houston Post. He's deceased now, but he coined the Country Caruso. And I was telling my wife and several people the other day that I was certainly glad that 90% of the country music listeners didn't know who Caruso was, because that's hard to live by, you know.
I'm wondering, you know, during the period when you were able to sing, but you couldn't really speak, and this was before you had a really good diagnosis of what your problem was, what was it like to not be able to talk? I mean, you couldn't have...
For an example?
Yeah, you couldn't have normal
being
relationships
in an
with
airport,
people. Yeah.
Being in an airport in New York City and having your flight canceled, and you're all alone,
mm-hmm.
you're traveling alone, So you walk up to the ticket counter for some information. Will the flight be scheduled later? Do I need to change it to another airline? And you walk up to the desk frightened because you don't know what's going to come out. And they say, yes, sir, can I help you? And you go, and you turn around and walk off, exasperated. You go to a telephone to call home that you're going to be late. So you try to talk to the operator. Hello, this is the operator. This is the operator. Buzz. You know. So when you lose your ability to communicate, and you, doesn't matter whether you're in New York City or Podunk, Arkansas, you're in trouble.
So you wouldn't know when you'd open up your mouth whether your voice would come out or not.
No.
Sometimes it would, and sometimes it wouldn't.
I would go into the men's room and practice mentally, step by step. I'll walk up to the ticket counter. I'll say, pardon me, will my flight so-and-so be rescheduled or not? I would practice that mentally. So I'd walk up to the desk sometime, and sometime it would work, sometime it wouldn't. And the worst thing in the world, if somebody would say, what's the matter with your voice? Then it was totally over, you know.
Wow, I can't imagine how bad that must have felt for you, such a great singer, to so totally lose control vocally.
Well, to be talking to my producer on the telephone, him setting up a session, and me saying, I can do it, go ahead and set the session, I'll be there 8 o'clock in the morning. And he said, man, are you all right? Are you sure? I set the session up. I'll be there. I promise I can sing. I could sing, but I couldn't talk. And they panicked and dropped me from the label.
Right.
And, you know, I have no hard feelings against them because they didn't know.
Johnny Bush. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Here's another song from his new CD, Talk to My Heart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Yesterday, as I talked to a friend in town, I forgot to remember that you're gone. For a moment, I found myself smiling, but a moment isn't very long. And last night, as I danced with a stranger, and she held her cheek close to my own, for a moment, I almost...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling.
That's Johnny Bush, recorded in 1967. Coming up, he talks about his friendship with Willie Nelson, the man Bush once advised to stop singing and just play guitar. Also, rock critic Ed Ward profiles blues singer and guitarist Lonnie Johnson.
The summer's gone and all the leaves are dying. It's you, must go, and I must buy. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when hushed or white with snow.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with country singer Johnny Bush. He's making a comeback after losing his voice in 1972 due to a rare neurological condition called spasmodic dysphonia. Voice training has helped him sing and talk in spite of the disorder. In the 60s, he was known as the Country Caruso. Let's hear one of his country hits from the 60s. This is a song he wrote, The Sound of a Heartache.
Loneliness surrounds me where your arms used to be. Sitting at the same old table where you used to sit with me. But I guess my heart's not strong enough to find someone new. 'Cause like a madness that I can't control, every girl reminds me of you. And I can hear the sound of a heartache from the music that the jukebox plays so loud. Yes, I can hear of a heartache above the noise of happy people in that crowd.
Johnny Bush recorded in the 60s before his vocal disorder. When we left off, we were talking about what it was like when he first started losing his voice and had trouble singing and often couldn't speak. It changed everything in his life, including his relationships with family, friends, and fans. What about if somebody recognized you and said, oh, you're that great singer Johnny Bush, and you'd want to say thank you?
Sing my cup runneth over.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that happened a lot. So had I been told from day one, Johnny Bush, you have what is known as spasmodic dysphonia. It affects one out of every 35,000 people. Johnny Bush, there is no cure for this, but through speech therapy and proper breath control, we can get you through life. I could have handled that. I wouldn't have hid from my fans. I wouldn't have tried to go hide on the bus. I didn't want them to know, you know. I hope this is coming across the way I really mean it. I love those people that bought my records and bought the tickets and come out to see me, but I didn't want them to see me in that condition to where my face would distort when I would try to talk and nothing would come out, and they'd say, what's wrong with you? You know, I just couldn't handle it.
And you wouldn't know what the answer is because you thought it was some kind of psychological defect as opposed to a neurological disorder.
I thought eventually it would go away as quickly as it came on.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping that would be the case.
Now, how did you start performing again?
I never stopped. I owed too much money. I couldn't stop. I kept the band. So what I started doing to stay visual, see, in this business, a lot of people they've already heard you sing. They want to see you. They want to touch. They want to talk. They want an autograph. They want you to shake their hand. They want to take their picture with you. So I decided to stay on the bandstand as long as possible, so I learned to play the fiddle. This way I could stay visual, stay on the bandstand, at the same time be doing something productive. This would rest the larynx for a few minutes to where I could sing a couple of more songs, then I'd play fiddle again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is country singer and songwriter Johnny Bush. And for about 26 years, he's had a vocal disorder. that for several years prevented him from talking at all. And he's making a recording comeback, and he's able to talk again. And his latest CD is called Talk to My Heart. Now, I know Willie Nelson figures into your story, and you figure into his story. And after you lost your voice, well, just before you had these vocal problems, you had written the song Whiskey River. And
yes.
you made a recording of it, I think, just at about just before you lost your voice.
Yes.
And then Willie Nelson recorded that song something like 9 times. Do I have that right?
At last count, he's recorded it 9 different times, and I'm really proud of that.
Did you write the song for Willie Nelson?
No, I wrote it for me because I had just signed with RCA, and I had a new producer by the name of Jerry Bradley, who is the son of Owen Bradley, who discovered Patsy Cline. He was the king of Decca Records. His son had just taken over right under Chet Atkins at RCA, and he was going to be my producer, so he said, we need a hit. Why don't you write one? And I said, all these great songwriters in Nashville, and you want me to write the song? He said, that's right. So he put the ball right into my court. So we had a stopover between the disc jockey convention in Nashville, going back to San Antonio, and Texarkana, Texas. So I woke up with Whiskey River, Take My Mind, Don't Let Her Memory Torture Me. That's all I had. So by the time I got to San Antonio, I'd written the song, and I called him up on the phone and sang it to him. It only has a verse. It has one verse and one chorus. Generally, country songs have 2 or 3 verses, you know. It was pretty short, direct, to the point. So my question to Willie was, should I write another verse? He said, no, I don't think so. He said, you've already said everything that can be said. He said, I would sing the verse, sing the chorus, turn it around, and then sing it out, which I did. It became a number one record for me. Since then, like, he's recorded it 9 different times. Well, now, his version is different from mine, but that's all right. It's just how he interprets it a little different than I do.
Well, we're going to hear your version, which I believe you recorded in about 1972.
Thank you. It was recorded in 71.
Okay.
And released in 72.
Good enough. So this is Johnny Bush singing his own song, Whiskey River.
I'm drowning in a whiskey river. Bathing my memoried mind in the wetness of its soul. Feeling the amber current flow ever on my mind. And warm my empty heart she left so cold. Whiskey River, take my mind. Don't let her memory torture me. Whiskey River, don't run dry. You're all I've got, take care of me.
That's Johnny Bush's 1972 recording of his own song, Whiskey River, which Willie Nelson has recorded 9 times. Now, how did you and Willie Nelson first meet?
It was the year of 1953. I was working with a band called Mission City Playboys in San Antonio, Texas. It was a Sunday night. This was a place that we affectionately refer to today as a skull orchard. You know what a skull orchard is?
No.
You know what a honky-tonk is?
Yeah.
A skull orchard is the worst kind of honky-tonk.
And what makes it so bad?
The people that frequent the place makes it so bad. People looking for trouble,
right.
Trying to forget trouble or looking for trouble.
Got the picture. Okay.
So these people congregate. They like country music, and they like to dance, so... This young redheaded guitar player and his fiddle player came through the door and wanted to set in. It was customary back then that you let guys set in, you know. So they, good guitar player, good fiddle player. So Dave Isbell hired them both. So Willie became, and I become fast friends. And at the time, he was married to his first wife, Martha, and Lana Nelson was just barely walking. And so she was less than a year old. That's how we met and been friends ever since. He's worked for me, I've worked for him, and it's just been a relationship that's lasted. It's timeless.
My guest is country singer Johnny Bush. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
In a place where no one knows us, we hold secret rendezvous.
Back with country singer and songwriter Johnny Bush. And he's had a vocal disorder for about 26 years that for a while left him unable to talk. And it's affected his singing, too. And he seems to have both under control now. And he has a wonderful new CD called Talk to My Heart. Willie Nelson wrote in his autobiography, Johnny Bush advised me to quit trying to sing. He liked my guitar playing better than he liked my voice. So is that true? Did you try to get him to stop singing?
I'm going to answer that. I have at home in my files a demo of Willie Nelson singing a couple of his songs. I wish you could hear her because that's the way he sang when I made that remark. He was a great guitar player and a fair singer back in those days when he was 19 years old. He became the great singer that he is today, the same way Ray Price did. You listen to Ray Price's 1951 record on Bullet, compare that to his later Columbia records, and you see this wonderful, beautiful transition. Same thing happened to Willie. But for some reason, Willie has never forgotten that. I asked him, I said, you know, I like your guitar playing better than your singing. I still love his guitar playing. But for some reason, it was probably the only thing I ever said that really hurt his feelings to that point to where he never forgot it. And he never fails to mention it anywhere, especially in his book, you know. Speaking of books, I'm in the process of putting mine together now, and I'm going to straighten all of that out.
Well, good for you. Well, you shouldn't worry too much, because it didn't hold Willie Nelson back from success.
No. First of all, my opinion wouldn't have mattered, did it? Back in those days, it was, according to Willie's philosophy, you know, everybody has an opinion. It's what you think of yourself that's important, not what somebody else thinks of you. So... the only thing that bothers me is I have to admit I did say that, but it was not to intentionally hurt his feelings or to set him back. It just, at the time, happened to be the truth.
You've written some great country songs, and a lot of the songs that you've written and a lot of the songs by others that you sing, like many country songs, emphasize being in love, losing love, being cheated on, cheating on somebody, and, of course, drinking. Do you have plenty of experience to write from in these categories?
Not any more than anyone else, but I try to do it this way. I try to put myself in the place of the man with the problem. For instance, you remember when Frank Sinatra played The Man with the Golden Arm, where he was addicted to heroin, and he was a drummer?
Sure do.
He's an actor. He was playing a part. He was able, in his mind, to become a heroin addict and play this part so magnificently. I think he got an Academy Award nomination for it. To me, a singer, a songwriter, should have the same poetic license. You don't have to go down on Skid Row and drink a bottle of hot Thunderbird wine to imagine what's going through a wino's mind, would you? I would think not. I just try to put myself in the position of the man that has the hurt. So that's what I try to do.
I have one more question for you.
Sure.
About your voice. I've kept you talking for some time here during this interview. Do you have to actually think about speaking as you speak and think about the process and think about the breathing?
The breathing and the relaxation, yes.
And is that an effort? Does it make it more tiring to speak?
No.
Because it has to be a conscious process.
I would rather have it than cancer. I would rather have it than to live my life in a wheelchair. Sometime I think I'm very fortunate that the Lord put this on me for a reason. And one day I'll know the reason why. In the meanwhile, I'm overcoming it. I'm a stronger person. I'm a better person. And also, I'm in a position now to help a lot of people who are out there scared to death, wondering what in the world happened to their voice. The national association that deals with this disease contacted me the other day and asked me to represent them this year. So I'm going to become involved with them. Looking forward to it. Going to support groups and showing these people they're not alone. And not only are they not alone, but there is help.
Well, you sound great on your new CD, so I want to close our interview with a track from it. And I thought we'd play the title track, which is a song called Talk to My Heart. And I want to thank you, Johnny Bush, very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
My heart, because I'm lonesome. Pretend, even if it's not true. And don't be afraid that you'll hurt me. I'm hurting, that's why I need you. Please, please, I'm so lonesome. Any love you can give me will do. And don't be afraid, I'll start crying. I'm crying, that's why I need.
Johnny Bush from his new CD, Talk to My Heart. Tomorrow we'll talk about how the human voice works with a voice specialist and surgeon who treats singers. Coming up, Ed Ward profiles blues singer and guitarist Lonnie Johnson. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Bluesmen usually don't come from New Orleans, play with Duke Ellington, or open nightclubs at the age of 70, but singer and guitarist Lonnie Johnson was no ordinary bluesman. He was one of the most prolific recording artists of all time and raised guitar playing to new heights. Rock historian Ed Ward has a profile.
Lonnie Johnson, the biggest-selling blues man of the 1920s and 30s, was everything the other blues men weren't. Musically literate, urban, and able to play in a wide variety of styles and genres, he traveled internationally and was able to sustain a career for most of his life. Furthermore, he wasn't too crazy about blues. "I recorded 125 songs against the same chords," he once said. Alonzo Johnson was born in New Orleans in 1889, or 1894, or 1899. Nobody seems to know for sure. His whole family played music, and young Lonnie joined his father's band as a violinist. Switching to guitar, he played the bordellos in Storyville, and in 1917 he went to England with a review that entertained the troops, having survived the flu epidemic that killed most of the other members of his family. Settling in St. Louis, he formed a band with his brother James and worked on the riverboats that went up and down the Mississippi. This gave him a high enough profile to attract record company attention, and in 1925, he made his first record.
"I want all you people to listen to my song. I want all you people to listen to my song. Remember me after the days I'm gone.
Mr. Johnson's Blues was the first of hundreds of records he'd make over the next three decades. Johnson was a tireless worker and a consummate professional. He toured with Bessie Smith, had his own radio show in New York, and was a fixture on bandstands in both Cleveland and Chicago, where he worked with the first generation of Chicago bluesmen. But his virtuosity and fame also got him into situations no other bluesman could have coped with. Matching Louis Armstrong note for note on the scat chorus of Hotter Than That was an astonishing feat, but Johnson made it sound easy. Thus, when another famous jazz man came calling, he was ready. On Duke Ellington's 1928 recording of The Mooch, he courted behind Barney Bigard's clarinet and picked behind Baby Cox's vocal. He also recorded with white jazz guitarist Eddie Lang, although the record company billed Lang as Blind Willie Dunn to obscure the fact. When the Depression killed the record business, Johnson moved to Cleveland and only played part-time, but in 1937 he headed to Chicago and galvanized the scene that was gathering around Bluebird, RCA's race label there. As one of the label's studio musicians, he found himself on even more records. At an age where hard living, or at least declining popularity, had silenced most of his generation, Lonnie Johnson was still at it. In 1948, he actually had a number one R&B hit, Tomorrow Night.
Tomorrow night, will you remember what you said tonight? Tomorrow night, will all the thrills be gone? Tomorrow night, will it be just another memory? Just another lovely song. It's in my heart to linger on. Your lips are so tender.
Still, although he managed a couple of more smaller hits, he was smart enough to realize that it was time to retire, so he took a job at the Ben Franklin Hotel in Philadelphia and put it all behind him. It didn't work. As the folk revival of the early 60s gathered steam, he was rediscovered, re-recorded, put on the road with other blues singers whose careers had been revived, including his old friend Victoria Spivey, and toured Europe with blues reviews. In 1965, he moved to Toronto, where he opened a club called Home of the Blues. It took an automobile accident and a few strokes to slow him down, and his last public appearance was in Toronto with Buddy Guy in 1970, a few months before a final stroke killed him. Lonnie Johnson may not have fit the stereotype of the old, poor blues man, but his legacy of virtuosity continues to inspire guitarists the world around.
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. On the next Fresh Air, the human voice. We learn about the mechanics of speaking and singing from voice specialist Dr. Robert Sadeloff. He runs an emergency clinic for singers and has treated many famous performers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.